Hi everyone, Lucas Werner here. If you've been enjoying these conversations with artists, I invite you to come visit David's Werner Gallery exhibitions in person. We're located in New York, Los Angeles, London, Paris, and Hong Kong. New exhibitions open each month. Plan your visit at davidswerner.com. From David's Werner, this is Dialogues, a podcast about artists and the way they think.
I've never, ever, ever tried anything that I couldn't do. And as soon as I could do it, I was bored. My problem was much more about finding the thing that would not bore me. The thing that would not bore me was making art. And I knew that. And I knew the reason why it was going to never bore me, because I was never going to be able to do it as well as I could write.
Hi, I'm Lucas Werner. This season of Dialogues, we're inviting on new hosts for certain episodes so we can expand not only the diversity of our guests, but also of the subjects we tackle on the podcast. This episode, the curator and writer Jarrett Ernest is on a subject he has always been deeply interested in, serious artists who are also serious writers.
I'm Jarrett Ernest, your guest host for this episode. Today, I'm talking with legendary conceptual artist Lorraine O'Grady on the occasion of her retrospective, Both And, at the Brooklyn Museum, and on the release of her book, Writing in Space, which brings together essays and conversations from the last 40 years. This conversation picks up in the middle of our ongoing, years-long discussions of literature, philosophy, and history, dipping into our mutual love of filmmaker Maya Deren's book, Divine Horsemen, The Living Gods of Haiti, as well as the development of her autobiographical essay, Notes on Living a Translated Life, which was published in Hyperallergic late last year. O'Grady is unique for many reasons, not least for coming to art later in life, at the age of 40, after a successful career working for the Labor and State Department, running her own translation business, and becoming a critic. To contextualize this beginning of a conversation, which I'm having with artists who write or who engage with writing as a part of their work, you are kind of like the poster girl of this particular nexus.
Oh, yeah.
Because you came to art through writing, more or less, after having done very well a number of other things. It was almost like only after having been a translator, been a rock critic, been gone to the Iowa Writers' Workshop to study literature, that you then kind of ended up starting to make writing in the New York art world in the 80s.
Now, after a lifetime of translating, not just literature, but translating my life to others so that they could understand me, and also the kind of training that one has as an extreme minority in culture, of having to translate almost every single thing one reads or hears into terms that refer to one and that one can use. The process of translation means that you understand that there are things you can use. You just In the speech of others, you just simply have to be able to make them meaningful to one's own purposes, whether those are life purposes or art purposes or whatever, right? You know, but my work has always been about speaking and reading and writing across difference. And that one does not have to speak with people who are exactly like oneself in order to understand them or in order to get something meaningful or important, either accomplished for oneself or for the culture as a whole. And I was trained in that process from the earliest of childhood. You know, I learned how to read by reading, the Howard Pyle books on King Arthur and his knights, right? So my whole life has been translation. So this is, I would say, something that has sort of solidified itself in a way in the position that I'm taking now, which is that the binaries have to be modes of exchange.
Well, one of the things that's interesting to me about that and I think makes your work very complicated in ways I've always, as you know, identified with and been interested in, is that the threshold of difference that you're talking about is not just between a person to a culture or between a person and a person, but it's even at the threshold of a self in terms of how can you speak to or communicate some sense of understanding even within the interior of like who Lorraine is at this particular intersection.
Well, you know, I'm famously somebody who didn't get out from under their mother until they were 40. You know, for the first 25 years of my life, I would say I was still living under my mother's plan for me. But I was somebody who had a lot of different talents. You know, I was verbally skilled and so forth, but I was also artistically skilled in a way that she recognized. not from my fourth grade novel, which she shut down like a ton of bricks, right? But they came at, I was about 14, I think, when I decided that the clothes that I was finding, there was an outfit that I wanted that I couldn't find anywhere, not even in Filene's basement, right? And I said, I want to make a dress, a sheath dress with a short cape. So we went out and we found a pattern that actually was exactly what I wanted. And then we went to look for some fabric. Now, I had never sewn a single thing. My mother, of course, was a professional dressmaker. So, you know, she had all of the tools at home, including a very fancy Singer sewing machine. And she said, well, listen, you can't just buy expensive fabric because to try out on, you know, because you've never sewn anything before. And I said, no, I want this fabric. So she gave in and she bought this fabric, which is very expensive, very beautiful. And she sat with me beside me at the sewing machine and said, now do this and do that. And she said to me about 20 years later, she said, you know, I watched you making this dress. And I said to myself, is this girl a genius or what? And then you never made another thing. Okay, because she didn't pick up on the fact that maybe she should start pushing me in that direction. She only picked up on the fact, Lorraine debates. She's a brilliant debater. She does this, she does that. She can be a lawyer. You understand? And so everything I was pushed to do until I was 25 was to live out that dream. If you can't be a lawyer, at least you can work for the government, you know, whatever, whatever. So I actually had gone on my senior interviews to some of the fancier, department stores, some of them boutique department stores, but still department stores for jobs. But I found that the conditions of women in those department stores in the back rooms off the floors were just horrible. You know, they could be buyers, but their legs must have been being bitten alive by fleas, you know, from the carpets that never got properly cleaned, right? So it was just awful. Even at Bonwit Tellers. And so I came back saying, okay, I'm going to take these exams for the government pretty seriously, right? You know, I got the right amount of sleep and everything, and I aced them. And, you know, like 20,000 people had sat for this one particular exam, and only about 500 of them passed the written, and then only 200 passed the oral. So I said, well, okay, you know, maybe this is what I meant for. And it wasn't until I had sort of spent 5 years at the Department of Labor, basically just not being able to be seen, not being able to express myself, not being able to, you know, be who I was, that I understood that this grayed out world was not for me. And so that was when that was the first stage of getting out from under my mother, right? You know, was like quitting the Department of Labor and going off to Europe, right, to write a novel. And they came back, and I started working for the Department of State, and she thought, well, maybe there's hope. But, you know, then I didn't pass the final. It was complicated. I didn't get the final Q clearance. And so then I had to figure out what to do with myself. And I said, okay, now is the time. So I plunged, and I went to the Iowa Writers' Workshop. And she wasn't happy at all. She was not happy with that. And I think that the reason that she wasn't happy was that by doing something like that, I was moving out of the worlds and out of the frameworks that she could discuss. I started remaking myself at 25, but always sort of with an eye to maybe doing something that would make her feel that it was worth it.
Well, what is so interesting to me about this story, and I've never heard you lay it out in particular in this way before, is when thinking about the question of translation, it brings it not only to translation within the family unit, you know, which one would not necessarily imagine having to translate across. But of course, there are those boundaries. Yeah. And that in and of itself was a way of addressing the question of translating parts of yourself to yourself.
Yeah. Well, I actually did something that I thought she might think was okay. When I came to New York with this guy who was in the rock business, I wasn't with him, I was following him, you know, how that goes. But anyway, it was the right time for me to get out of Chicago. And I must say that just in between that, I had gone to the Iowa Writers' Workshop at a moment when the Cahiers du Cinéma was the biggest thing in the world, you know, and so Rogrier and all of those people were, you know, big role models for my husband. I married a guy whose whole world was Rogrier and all of his movies, and was trying to be a little mini Rogrier, and all of this was, you know, French culture at its worst, as far as I, you know, French culture at its most anal, and I couldn't find myself in the things that everybody around me was getting very excited about, so that made it sort of easy. So finally, I and my husband, we just kind of had a split there, and then I had met this guy who was managing rock bands and sort of like found it was very easy to be around him. So I enjoyed that. And then he got a job. His rock band didn't work out so well. And so he got a job at Columbia as the head of press relations. So I kind of like followed. It was about the time that my translation business, I had a translation business in Chicago, for Playboy, basically, and the Encyclopedia Britannica, and both of those. Hugh Hefner was in the process of moving to California, and the Encyclopedia Britannica was finishing. You know, once the job is done, it's done, right? So then you have to figure out, like, where the next job's going to come from. And I didn't want to get into that process. So it seemed to me that if I was going to do something, now was the time. So this friend that I met and went to New York, his going was sort of like the catalyst for my going, you know, but not necessarily for him, but for myself, right? For the second phase of trying to become me, right? But instead of, you know, becoming me, I was sort of becoming him and, you know, doing, you know, rock criticism, right? You know, it's not something I would normally have done, right? But I was in that world. So I had to fit into that world. And lo and behold, I did something that was just absolutely weird. I wrote about the Allman Brothers, whom I'd been listening to a lot before I had left Chicago, and I wrote this piece. And their timing was such that the piece was right for them. You know what I'm saying? So I didn't know their timing, right? But it turned out it was right for them, and so. But I wasn't quite sure that they would take this. All of the work I was doing for them was unsolicited. I mean, the first thing that I landed on that poor Elaine Marks, I think her name was, she was the cultural editor of The Voice at the time. First thing that landed unbidden on was this 3,000 word piece on the Allman Brothers Band, right? And then I said, well, you know, there's not any guarantee that somebody's going to want to publish this. So let me find something else that they might want to publish. So I did a piece on Soul Train, you know, just a TV review. So Soul Train, and I think it was about the day that he tested out reggae and found it wanting, you know.
Well,
landed me on the front cover of the Village Voice, the first thing I ever did. So I thought my mother would be proud. And she wasn't. She immediately switched the topic. At that point, I realized for the first time deeply, and I was almost 40 because I was born in 34, I realized deeply that nothing would ever please her. And so I would have to find who I was and what would please me. And that started the whole process.
Right. So the earliest piece in your book is the piece on the Allman Brothers, which is an extremely interesting piece given the rest of the book. It's written in a very personal voice about you going through a bad breakup and listening to the Allman Brothers so deeply. And even though you don't like white rock and roll, you love this music and kind of writing through the complexity of that.
Yeah. And why do I love this music so much? You know, it's like, I loved it. I didn't realize why I loved it. Perhaps even when I was writing it as much as I do now, that was a strange moment in American musical history, a very strange moment. It was a moment when a white band like the Allman Brothers Band could tap into the blues in a genuine way. It was the same moment when a gospel blues singer could tap into the white world, and that was Aretha Franklin. I mean, the Allman Brothers and Aretha Franklin's careers overlapped, and they overlapped at the same studio, Fame in Muscle Shoals, right? And Duane had been working with the same band that backed. I mean, most people don't seem to realize this, that the critical and most identifiable moment of Aretha Franklin's career was done in a white studio with white musicians, okay? And it was just this extraordinary group of very young musicians at Muscle Shoals who just could be anything to anybody. Do you know what I'm saying? They were that good. And they had no problems, of course. They themselves had been, people don't realize how much, how complicated the South was, that Southern white boys were as much raised on blues as, you know, black boys were. But everybody was sort of like taking their own roots to it. So the Southern white boys were more into country and I don't know. I guess, you know, good music is good music. What can I say? Good music is good music wherever you find it. And those who make it don't really make the kind of distinctions that some of those who listen to it make. They're moving in and out of quality as far as they're concerned. So they make whatever the best they can be. They're the best that they can be at whatever it is that they're doing at the moment.
When you were studying writing at Iowa Writers Workshop, and you basically talk about it to the extent that you say that you had these problems with writing that you then kind of identify as as being related to narrative. And so what was it that in particular about your writing that never satisfied you, that led you to move, but you felt that you could address properly in performance and in visual art?
Well, you know, I mean, basically, that's a question that I would not have known exactly how to answer at the time, although I can see how I ultimately answered it. I just knew that the work wasn't good. It was rather sophomoric in the sense of my skills, my skill level was sophomoric to what it was I was trying to accomplish. This idea of wanting literature to have a beginning, middle, and end, but not necessarily in that order, and that the recommended way of starting was, you know, in the middle of things. Before I tried to master those things, I somehow felt that that wasn't what I was looking for. I kind of sensed that that was not going to work for me, and I don't know why I felt that way, and I couldn't have named it at the time, but I've since come to understand that what I really was looking for was a writing that not only didn't have the beginning, middle, and end in that order, but didn't have either a beginning or an end or a middle. Now, I do know that it wasn't as radical as all that. Even conceptual art was not as radical as all that. And that I've gone way beyond that. Now, in my thinking anyway, whether or not I can do it, whether or not I'm going on beyond that in my actual achievement, that's a whole other story, but in my thinking. And I did know that what I wanted to do, that the only possible place for me to write the way I wanted to write was in space. That I got out of reading Lucy, right? And so I began almost immediately thinking of myself as writing in space. This was almost immediately, as soon as I started actually doing something, you know, there was a long period of preparation in order to do. So from 1974 to 1977, when I did the cutting out the New York Times, I wasn't doing anything except reading, you know, reading and thinking.
One thing that is kind of enigmatic to me when I realized it, because I know you as someone who reads very widely and very deeply, like all over, kind of voracious mind and reader, and then to realize that for most of your adult life until you were 40, it seems as though you were not interested in visual art at all. And
no, so, I was still living in a world where, and to a certain extent, Jarrett, I still am, where the visual arts don't have too much to say about real political solutions. They think they do sometimes. They you know, they pat themselves on the back, but nobody's paying any attention to them because they're so irrelevant. I mean, I've been trained in the political sciences. You know, my degree is in economics. I didn't start thinking about my concerns as cultural, as philosophical, until I was about 25. It was really funny. I think some people around me sort of saw it before I did, you know, it's always the way. I mean, I didn't have a framework to put these things, but other people were seeing me in this way, you understand? That I didn't start to see myself until I was almost 40. And I was still thinking of politics and culture as, you know, two separate things.
Well, given that you talked about the kind of powerlessness of the intellectual or political ambition or effect of art or the cultural sphere, it's like, what is it that you now feel is possible within that space?
Well, I started with a very clear, and I haven't really changed, this is something I haven't changed. You know, a lot of things I keep changing, but this one I haven't changed. And that is that that the art world is a perfect microcosm of the real world. Okay. And not only is it a perfect microcosm, it's probably an extreme microcosm of the real world. It's more prejudiced, more class stratified, more wealth stratified, more self-satisfied than the rest of the world. But it worked to me, it looked to me always that I could, that there was nothing that I could say about the real world that I could say that was so diverse and so forth that could not be better said about the art world, which at least offered a shape, a singular shape that could be addressed with infinite ramifications for the real world.
Well, I would also say, I want to go back to something. I love the story of you watching Vito Acconci and saying, like, nobody gave him permission to do this. He's doing it. And people accept that and saying, you know, I'm going to do that. I think that that's a kind of very deep recognition that all artists have to have, that like no one's going to give you the permission to start making your work the way you want to make it.
But on the other hand, the reason why there are so few artists that achieve their goals or their self, the realization of their best ideas is that, you know, it takes a lot to have that whatever it is that says, okay, I can do it. And then, and set out to do it. And people have often asked me where I got the confidence from. And I don't know that I had confidence. I just had... I'd had enough success in the world, you know, to think that I've never tried anything that I couldn't do. I've never, ever, ever tried anything that I couldn't do. And as soon as I could do it, I was bored. So, you know, my problem was much more about finding the thing that would not bore me. And the thing that would not bore me was making art. And I knew that. And I knew the reason why it was going to never bore me, because I was never going to be able to do it as well as I could write.
I was so struck by, and I'm sure this has been pointed out, but I've never read it discussed, the story about you making the sheaf dress with the cape, the parallel with your first real performance art piece that was public of Mademoiselle Bourgeois
Noir.
A sheaf dress with a cape.
Oh my God, that's so true. That's so true. I mean, there are a lot of things that happen unconsciously. And for instance, I think I was telling you that The River's First Draft, which is the most surrealist, futurist piece, both surrealist and futurist, I did that piece in 1982. And I had started my journal in 1978, I started a journal in 1978 that included dreams, because I was at that moment after 1977 when I did Cutting Out the New York Times, and I had to figure out, like, where am I going? What am I doing now? And I tried to use this. People use journals. People think they use journals just to write about what happened. They don't. They use journals to try to figure out how to solve problems that haven't been solved. That's what journals are about.
So to kind of loop back to a question about writing, what you eventually arrived upon in your work was a structure that was the diptych structure, which you, through employing it, realized was an anti-binary tool where you could put things next to each other and they would be simultaneous rather than either or. Yeah. They would be both and. So when you arrived at the act of putting two things next to each other, which on one hand has the great virtue of seeming kind of effortless or faded, when did you realize that it was starting to work against this binary distinction that you had been trying to undermine?
Well, almost from the beginning, I understood something. You know, I mean, obviously, every year you do it, you get more and more understanding of what it is. The resistance, the opposition that I get to it in the beginning. I mean, the first major diptych that was out in the world and being discussed was The Clearing. Okay, and everybody, there were two primary responses that this must be the before and the after, you know? And I said, to me, this is what every relationship consists of all the time, simultaneously. The ecstasy and the exploitation, you know, they're simultaneous. But that was an argument that, you know, nobody seemed to get. And then the other one was, that's not what love is supposed to be. That's not what sex is supposed to be, right? But, you know, but it is. That's what it is, and it has been.
But that's what it is.
That's what it is, you understand? So it wasn't until I got the opposition to the diptych that I realized how much it was overturning in people's capacities to think. And that was the biggest problem. I always felt that the biggest problem was the hierarchizing of cultures. That, to me, was always the biggest problem.
Well, in our previous conversations, it struck me that our almost structural attraction to other things we share, like thinking of the Tale of Genji or thinking of Maya Deren's book on voodoo, is that those are both highly syncretic.
Syncretic, contexts. That's the word that I was using, syncretic, yeah. One thing that I began to wonder about when I began to wonder about religion was why it was that the Greek gods, Greek and Roman gods and goddesses that we studied in school when I was a kid, why they always seemed so much more believable to me than the god that I studied in church, you know? And that's because they were that pantheism really is more about the different parts of the human mind and the human psyche. And so the idea that there is a god in charge of this particular thing and another god in charge of the totally opposite thing made more sense to me, that there was one god in charge of everything. You understand? At the simplest level. So I was myself drawn to pantheism from earlier, but I found in Deren this kind of way of responding. I would say that Deren was more of an appreciator than she was a believer. Do you know what I mean? She was a believer, but she wasn't limited by that belief. But she was definitely an appreciator of this form of believing. I'm becoming a little bit more suspicious of people who look to the past for validation.
Mm-hmm.
You understand? And look to auxiliary cultures for validation, you know. And I think that the moment when Vodun became big in African American circles was just this moment in about the 1950s or so, 30s, 40s, 50s, in that period, when African Americans, educated African Americans, were interested in finding validation outside of the culture of their culture for their culture. Do you understand? But the dance forms and the whatnot forms of that were appropriated in a sense by Dunham and Pearl Primus and others for contemporary African American culture. I think that was like a source of both validation and expansion. Okay, but I have to say that the actual Black church certainly never thought so. Do you know what I mean? Didn't follow them there. This is a very intellectual activity, this recuperation of these other cultures, right? And
well, how would you how would you relate to what Maya Deren's book does in that sense? Because she, in and of herself, is translating her own immigrant experience and ideals as an artist into her experience of Haitian religion.
Right. Well,
and in a way, I think that if you want to talk about artists who write, that's the best artist who wrote. I mean, to me, it's the best book.
Yeah, I would say, I would agree with you with that. one of the best artworks and one of the best books. She, mm-hmm. But she is not looking for, she is not looking for cultural validation. She's looking for personal recognition, you know? And that's what I feel I'm doing always. Finding themselves, finding oneself.
One of the things that struck me is in trying to deny the binary as a logic or as a structure in your work, that it places your you in a very interesting position, in that it is always in motion. And as you put together this book of collected writing and also your big retrospective simultaneously, it really is, there's a lot of weight because it is where you kind of tell, you present a certain story about what it is that you've done and your thought that may give the illusion of a stability of a position. And so I wondered how you navigated that in terms of...
Well, I don't
of
know that... I'll tell you something, Jarrett. I'm finding this process so much more educational than anything that's happened to me in the last 10 years that, like, you know, I'm still in the middle of it. I think that I've never had so much attention paid to me, so many questions asked of me, that I didn't necessarily know the answers to and that I'm having to think through, that it's really wonderful. It's a great occasion for learning about myself and the work that I had not, I mean, I knew I would learn something when I saw, I imagined that I would go into the to the exhibition and see everything together and that would be the educational moment for me. I hadn't realized that the educational moment was the questioning. You know, that was it. That would be it. And that began well, even while I was while I was working with you on in 2016, and out of that came the first sort of, well, you know, you've read the piece in Hyperallergic, so you know probably which parts I wrote for that seminar you did and which parts I wrote for the task at hand, which was the Garden Museum exhibition, right? So somehow or the other, that process of learning in a slightly different way, but still translating, but learning somehow in a different way, that I really liked that piece that I did for the Gardner Museum.
Oh, I love it. Maybe you could, for the purpose of this conversation, right at the time of the 2016 election, I was teaching a free experimental art seminar, and Lorraine came to my class, and there were five people in the class, and you had written a text for them to read and discuss. And it was like we met, I think, the Sunday after the 2016 election.
Oh, was that what it?
And there was.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And so it was this very specific moment I remember of the seven of us sitting in this warehouse with a view of the Statue of Liberty. We're in Brooklyn and talking about this piece that you wrote. And for the purpose of this, would you describe how that piece started, which is, I really loved. It was really deeply about your education in a way, and how it ended up in, how it evolved as a piece of writing into the piece that you published for the Gardner Museum.
Well, it was very simple. It was Boston, right? That piece was about Boston. It was about me as a child in Boston. And I had not ever written anything about me as a child in Boston before. So it was very autobiographical, but it was also very place and family centered. So it started at the simplest level an explanation of myself that I hadn't previously given about who I was and how I came to be. I certainly didn't finish the autobiography that might have been the opening moment of. You know, I didn't yet go there. So it just sat in the, I had a lot of other things to do, so it sat in a drawer and I didn't, and it wasn't until this young man had encountered these images in a totally overlooked, drawer at the Gardner Museum and said, what can I do with these? Or what should I do with these? And he contacted a young woman who teaches African-American art history at Wellesley, her name is Nikki Green. And he said, what should I do with these? And she said, I think you should talk to Lorraine because she's the only one who comes from Boston, right? And who kind of knows that. And she's old enough to know that history in that time period, or at least something of it, And he contacted me. And for about a year, we had these, this incredible exchange of emails about, this, that, and the other thing connected to Boston and, Boston society and Black society and whatnot. And so the first thing that happened was he knew that he wanted me to write for the catalog, but I had already said no because I didn't have time. And then he said, well, if you can't write for the catalog, you have to do something for the facade, right? And so I did this, I transformed Strange Taxi, which is about my mother and my aunts, and put it on the facade. And then I thought a little bit, it could be kind of interesting. maybe instead of just talking about his question, if I sort of combine my questions with his questions, I might get something interesting, And so that was when that's how that piece started. It was kind of like, I had it for you for that moment, for the 2016 moment. And then I had to kind of find another way to make it more, somehow still more personal, more about me. And that was about talking about my father, who I never talked about.
The last question I want to ask you is a structural question, which is that, which I had said before, an exhibition is still a narrative form.
Yeah.
It's just not linear form. And I'm wondering, in the way that you are trying to break up the either or logic and also the kind of the forward narrative progression of history, how that's reflected in the way that that your book of collected writing was put together, which is non-chronological, mm-hmm. and also the way that you're looking at staging the exhibition.
Well, I don't take full credit for the organization of the book. And there were things that I disagreed with at the time, but disagreements can tend to become less and less interesting as time goes by. In some ways, I'm thinking of a new book as a way of correcting some of the things that I disagreed with in the first book, things that I wasn't responsible for, somebody else was.
I love that.
But I could not have ever done that. I couldn't have done the first bit of organizing of my own work. It was just too big. It was just too big and too overwhelming for me to have done that. Somebody else had to do it, And I thought it was pretty good. It was pretty good as it turned out. I could never have had an idea as smart as putting those two biographical statements as the introduction of me. That was a great idea. And there was a lot of other great ideas, but there were just some things that I would have done differently. And then there were some things that I would do now that I had never done before. So it's a matter of not just correcting, but really adding what I was becoming while all of those pieces were being written,
It's such a beautiful portrait of the way that you work as a thinker and a writer that your book has yet to come out and your show has yet to open, and you're already making a new piece that's a response to it.
I'm making a new piece in response to the questions that I'm getting from you and from others, you know. It's really wonderful. It's really wonderful. I hope I can write as fast as I think I might be able to write, you know. That's the big question, right? I'm in the process right now of moving, and the thing that I'm moving is my books. I've got three quarters of my books are over in a storage space. And I'm going to be taking the ones that I still want to relate to and learn from and bringing them back over here into my living space.
We mentioned earlier your piece, which is titled Black Dreams, that's reproduced in your...
Yeah.
It's reproduced in your book. And I wanted to read a little section from it, because in one of the dreams you talk about making an artwork, which I don't think you ever made other than you wrote about it. So I guess that kind of makes it into a thing. But you talk about wanting to make a piece dedicated to Walter Benjamin. Yeah. And it said, mounted on three dry... you're describing what the piece would be. Mounted on three dry walls was to be a life-sized photo reproduction of my library alcove. The shelves contain about 3,000 volumes. In the center of the alcove, my actual desk, extremely cluttered, a typing table and chair, and scattered about on the floor, a jumble of packing crates with labels not yet filled in.
Well, I actually built a lot of the crates of that, you know, and the housing some of my books here, but I never did the piece. I built the book just to see how it might work, because there was a certain point at which there were actually going to be crates on the floor, there were crates on the wall, whatever. But I do see my relationship to books as shifting around constantly. You know, not just individual books, but, you know, individual subsections of the library, you know. Some might just say, I'm not going back there anymore, and I haven't gotten enough out of this. Or, you know, if I go back to this other one, I'll get something new. And I also enjoy going back to new work. And see, everybody needs models, I think. Everybody needs models in order to keep moving, right? Unfortunately, I don't find the models that I need in the work that I see out there. I wish I did, but I don't. The models that I see are in the work that I've done. So the biggest influence on my work is my work. That's a little narrow-minded possibly, but I don't see why finished bodies of work can't be considered sketches for new bodies of work.
Right.
That's it.
But I guess my question about the models, Lorraine, is that if you had encountered in your world in some science fiction way, the work of Lorraine O'Grady, it wouldn't have necessarily provided a model, because you wouldn't have had to make that work, because it would have existed.
Yeah.
And so I think that the way that models work, a quote-unquote model, for a younger artist or writer is very interesting, because it's not like it's not like you can do what it does, because there's no need for that. But it almost shows you that something is possible, and it provides it creates a space in the world for you to think.
Yeah, I wish that I had been more in time with my generation instead of after my generation.
What do you mean by that?
Well, if I had been actually making work at the same... Well, who's my age? Who's my age that I can think of? Oh, let's say most of the artists that were making work, artists, visual artists, right, that were making work that were my age were male. That's male and misogynist, okay? You know, but if I had been making art at the same time that Stanley Whitney and Frank Bowling and Jack Whitten and people like that had been making art, Sam Gilliam, you know, I would have been able to make my arguments more at that time. And so I didn't have anybody to show me how to go further, because I was starting already having had the benefit of what they had done, but I was their equal. I wasn't looking up to them. Do you know what I mean? They were not older than I was. They were the same age as I was. Now, there's one person that I wish that I had read more, but I find that I can't even read some of her work anyway, and that's Toni Morrison. Now, she was the same age, but she was really, I wish that I had had the confidence to see myself as an artist at that level so that I could have gone and introduced myself to her, but I would never have had that confidence. Why would she want to look at me, you know? But I've always been able to relate to her essays. All of her essays from the very beginning to now interest me. Let me just change the subject slightly, Jarrett, because I want to ask you a question. I think, I know you're talking about the linearity of the exhibition, and mm-hmm. I don't see my exhibition as being linear. It's not linear.
Well, that's what I'm asking you about.
It wasn't a linear body of work when I created it, and it's not a linear body of work on the wall. So it's a really spatialized exhibition, but I don't know, but still it has to be sequential, as you say, and whether or not mm-hmm. false sequences are being set up or not, I don't know. They tried to disrupt that, you know? So things are not chronological. They are somehow gathered around themes that are kind of like, you know, it's more thematic, I think. So the themes sort of sit beside each other and don't necessarily relate to each other or don't necessarily inform each other. I don't know. But I was just wondering about, I guess, did I write in space? did I finally achieve what I was hoping for? I don't know.
Well, because the exhibition hasn't opened yet, we can't really go much farther there. Yeah. But that's really the question that I have. You know, I think of your work so much as like a galaxy, or like all of these parts that are spinning around each other in, you know, ever greater complexity and informing each other based on, you know, gravity, you know, gravitational fields. And that's one reason why I think at this stage in your life and career, in which many people, I mean, you're 86.
Mm-hmm. Closer to 90 than to 80, right?
Because many, many artists at this moment in their life are, I wouldn't say slowing down, but I wouldn't say that they're where you're at, which is, in a way, you seem as interested and as busy in engaging the world that you've created than, you know, at any other point, because it's almost like there's a kind of a critical mass of texts and images and gestures in the world that they start really complicating each other.
Exactly.
And so I want to say thank you so much for this conversation, Lorraine. It's always a real, you know, a real joy to get to talk with you.
Well, thank you, Jarrett. And talking with you is always provocative and informing. This always stimulates me to new thinking, and I like that, and I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. Dialogues is produced by David Zwirner. You can find out more about the artists on this series by going to davidzwirner.com/dialogues. And if you liked what you heard, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. It really does help other people discover the show. I'm Lucas Zwirner. Thanks so much for listening, and I hope you join us again next time.